The Tom Woods Show, episode 446.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. It is episode 446. This is the episode on which I reveal the winner of the special sweepstakes that Shift Gold has been holding for my listeners. And we're giving away a $1,200 1 ounce Canadian gold maple leaf coin. I'll announce the winner at the end of the show. Now, I know you have a fast forward button. Just play along with me. I'm trying to build suspense here. So at the end of the show, I will reveal the name of the winner. The winner has not yet been notified. So the winner is going to find out about his or her winnings today, listening to this episode. Isn't that just super? I've been out of town since last week in New York City. I'll be back tomorrow with a fresh program. These are all fresh programs, of course, because you've never heard them before, so they're fresh, but I'll have a guest and we'll be back to normal tomorrow. But today, I want to share with you something that I think you will find interesting. A lot of times, libertarians and supporters of the free market are called fascists, right? It's a stupid, inane remark to make. How could we possibly be fascists when fascism was developed specifically as an alternative to laissez-faire capitalism, that was expressly the goal of the thing. Well, anyway, what I'm doing today is sharing with you one of the two lessons that I devote to fascism in my Ron Paul curriculum course on government. That's a 90-lesson course in which I pretty much tried to include all the knowledge I have. Well, not quite, but you understand what I'm getting at. I'm trying to take what it's taken me decades to learn and stuff it into these 90 lessons. The idea is it's a half-year course, 5 lessons a week, 18 weeks, hence 90 lessons, so that the high school students taking this homeschool curriculum will have the benefit of all that knowledge without the pain of having to acquire it quite so laboriously over all these years. So what I want to do is play for you this lesson. This is actually part two of my two-lesson series in the 90 lessons on fascism specifically. Why am I doing part two? I don't know. Make you hungry for part one, I suppose. You can easily listen to part two without having heard part one because I begin part two with a review of part one of the discussion of fascism. And as the lesson goes along, you'll see that I begin to get into the economics of fascism. We talk about how the economy of Nazi Germany actually worked, and you'll note that it's not exactly a free market. So this is stuff that is really right up the alley of my listeners. If your interest is piqued in this course, you can find out about all 90 lessons. You can see them all at tomwoods.com/government, and there you'll see links to get this course if you so desire. You can get this course a la carte and just listen to the 90 lessons or watch them. There are also videos as well, if you prefer videos, with you can see me in the corner of the screen and a PowerPoint on your screen. You can get that through tomwoods.com/government. You'll see the links for how to do that. You can also get it as part of the Ron Paul curriculum. And if you join the Ron Paul curriculum through ronpaulhomeschool.com, if you use that link to enter the site, and then you go on to join, remember, you get a couple of freebies. You get my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History signed to you, and you also get a free 10-lesson bonus course on the foundations of liberty. You have to ask me for those things, though, so write to me at tomwoods.com/contact after you sign up through ronpaulhomeschool.com. And of course, the final way to get these courses is to join me as a supporting listener of the show at supportinglisteners.com. The gold and platinum people get all the courses for the Ron Paul curriculum that I have created. All right, no more talking. Let's do some learning. Here we go. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods, and today we're going to continue our discussion of fascism. And last time we talked about some of the characteristic features of fascism. Nationalism is one, the emphasis on the glory and greatness of one's own nation, one's own people. We talked about the glorification of the state as, in effect, the embodiment of the people. The state is the great instrument of the nation by which it achieves greatness. The military, of course, helps to carry out some of the goals of the fascist. The fascist regime doesn't have to be militarily aggressive. but it does emphasize the martial virtues, that is, the virtues of the soldier, as being the most admirable and the most important. We talked about fascism as a third way, allegedly, between capitalism and communism. It rejects both. So anyone saying that a libertarian is a fascist obviously doesn't understand what fascism is, because it was self-consciously designed as being in opposition to capitalism as well as to a communism. The idea of the charismatic leader who embodies the will of the people and whose untrammeled will is law is also a characteristic feature of fascism, as we saw in the cases of Italy and Germany, both of which we examined in brief. Individual rights are subordinate to the good of the nation, and the public interest trumps the private interest. And then finally, we talked about political centralization also as being a central, so to speak, feature of fascism. So when you put all these together, you have a decent sense of what's going on in these regimes, what their outlook is. So we talked about Mussolini, who was a socialist turned fascist. He does not, when he takes power in 1922 in Italy, he does not engage in the whole-scale expropriation. Expropriation is a nice word for stealing of industry, the way Lenin did in Soviet Russia. To the contrary, he is going to leave private property more or less in private hands, although he's going to seize some of it. But he's certainly not going to have the fascist party administering all the factories and running all the industries, because he saw that that just led to chaos, starvation, and disaster when the communists attempted it. We saw that by early 1925, he had really become quite militant as a fascist. He had banned opposition newspapers. He had sent opposition leaders off to an island. More and more laws were passed granting him more and more authority, basically to rule by decree, to rule of his own accord. A secret police was established. A cult of personality was carefully cultivated by the news media to give the impression that Mussolini was really superhuman in a way, that he was extremely knowledgeable, endlessly energetic, tirelessly devoted to the Italian people. The corporate state aspect of Italian fascism largely remained more or less an illusion or a facade, let's say, in which the economy was supposed to be broken up according to industry. Then each industry would have the workers and the employers come together in different groups, and they would get together and decide what the rules and laws for that industry ought to be and what the wages ought to be that would be paid by everybody. But in fact, Mussolini basically ruled everything, so it was hard for anything to have real autonomy or real independence in fascist Italy. In Germany, we looked at the case of Hitler, who took power in January 1933 and just within a matter of days was consolidating that power and helping to establish a one-party state, which he thought would substitute the single will of a unified nation for the chaos and endless debate and fecklessness of a multi-party system. He exploits Article 48 of the German Constitution, allowing him to have the power to ban newspapers and public meetings. His emergency decree following the burning of the Reichstag at the end of the burning of the Reichstag, February 28, 1933, further extends the power of the government to interfere in the lives of individuals for the purpose basically of protecting allegedly the German people, but obviously just the Nazi regime in particular. We noted that the Enabling Act of March 1933 granted Hitler's administration more and more power, in effect to change the Constitution, to legislate, and so on. And finally, we ended by looking at quotations from two prominent members of the regime, basically saying that the law and Hitler's will, Hitler's desire, are the same thing. So this is the embodiment of the principles of fascism that we've seen. The charismatic leader, the nation trumps the individual, the so-called public interest trumps the private interest, the opposition to both capitalism and communism, the opposition to classical liberal restraints on the powers of government, all these features, and of course political centralization. Well, Hitler couldn't have been clearer about that, that he's not going to have any states' rights or nullification certainly not secession or anything like that in Germany. You can forget about that. There's going to be one power center, and it's going to rule over everybody. All right, so let's look at part two of our discussion. And I want to continue our discussion of Hitler a bit longer to solidify our discussion of how he ruled. Because, for instance, if there was an institution that was insufficiently pliant, that in other words, that wouldn't bend to Hitler's will as readily as he might like, he would create a duplicate institution. And then let that institution go to war with the first institution. So, for example, the Ministry of Labor was giving him problems, so he set up the General Plenipotentiary for Work Mobilization and listened to them. He established a duplicate economics ministry, the four-year plan under Goering. Or he had both Ribbentrop and Goebbels fighting over propaganda. And in fact, both their men would have battles over radio equipment, you know, which group of them was allowed to use it, and they would go to Hitler to arbitrate. And that's exactly where he wanted to be. He wanted to create division within the regime so that everybody would be at each other's throats. They wouldn't be at his throat. They'd be at each other's throats, and then they would need the great leader to arbitrate between them. You know what? Before going on to this slide, I'm afraid I'm going to forget to read you this passage here, so let me interrupt myself for a moment. I want to give you a sense of the character of the regime and what's beginning to happen already in 1933. This statement is from Heinrich Himmler, yet another important figure in the Nazi regime, and he's establishing concentration camps for enemies of the regime. And he writes, on Wednesday, 22nd March 1933, the first concentration camp will be opened near Dachau. It will accommodate 5,000 prisoners. Planning on such a scale, we refuse to be influenced by any petty objection, since we are convinced this will reassure all those who have regard for the nation and serve their interests. And then he says, the term commitment to a concentration camp is to be openly announced as until further notice. In certain cases, the Reichsfuhrer SS and the chief of the German police will order flogging in addition. There is no objection to spreading the rumor of this increased punishment to add to the deterrent effect. The following offenders, considered as agitators, will be hanged. Anyone who makes inciting speeches and holds meetings, forms cliques, loiters around with others. And then he says, anyone who, for the purpose of supplying the propaganda of the opposition with atrocity stories, collects true or false information about the concentration camps. So notice that. Whether you collect true or false information about the concentration camps, that can get you hanged. Okay, getting back to Hitler here. Hitler, as again, we'll talk all about this in Western Civ 2, but he did not hesitate to execute rivals, to execute enemies of his. He did this in the so-called Night of the Long Knives in 1934, very dramatically. But here I want to point out that Hitler, in a sense, was always a socialist. And it was his view. Again, you see this is compatible with fascism. He says every individual and group should work for what's best for the state. So it's Hitler's view that it doesn't matter who owns a factory as long as the factory owner does as he's told. As long as the owners do what they're told, it doesn't matter if they own it or not. So here's Hitler. He says, our socialism reaches much deeper. It does not change the external order of things. It orders solely the relationship of man to the state. Then what does property and income count for? Why should we need to socialize the banks and the factories? We are socializing the people. So if we get people voluntarily to want to do the right thing for the government, let them keep their crummy property. As long as we get them to do with it what we want. You get a sense here of Hitler's views on who's really in charge of the economy. He says that the job of the Ministry of Economics is to present the tasks of the national economy, and then the private economy will have to fulfill them. So we're in charge, we tell you what the goals are, and you will have to do what we say. And if the private economy fails to do so, and then these are Hitler's words again, then the National Socialist State will know how to solve these tasks. If that doesn't send a shudder up your spine, I guess you don't understand what he means by "we'll know what to do if you don't do what we're ordering you to do." In 1935, we have the so-called Nuremberg Laws. These are really codifying and extending previous regulations. The Jewish people are stripped of citizenship under these laws. They're declared to be mere subjects. We have the Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honor. This prohibits marriage or intercourse between Aryans and Jews, as well as with, quote, gypsies, Negroes, or their bastards, unquote. Jews were expelled from various activities. They were required to register with the state, and they had to give their children identifiably Jewish names. Here on the slide, if you want to pause the lesson and then maximize the screen, you can look at a detailed graphical depiction of the Nuremberg Laws and German blood and Jewish blood and what it all meant. It's quite an interesting and bizarre kind of flow chart here that you can maximize the screen by passing your cursor over the little rectangle in the lower right corner of the video screen that I'm on right now and then clicking on it, and then the video screen will take up your whole computer screen. I want to talk to you now about a book called The Vampire Economy, subtitled Doing Business Under Fascism. I've had you read a chapter from that book for this week, and I hope you found it interesting. It gives an indication of what economic life really was like. And if you can read this book and still think that Germany had a free market economy where business and individuals were free to buy and sell and interact with people as they wished, then there's no reaching you, because obviously this was nothing remotely like a market economy. Industrialists, for example, would be visited by state auditors who would have orders to examine their balance sheets. They'd be able to examine all their bookkeeping entries. And if the government found even the tiniest little mistake, they would impose tremendous financial penalties on that business. Now, obviously, what they were really doing was taking money from businesses, right? They just wanted to make it seem like there was some law that they were enforcing. Well, you forgot to carry the one, so that's going to cost you X zillion German marks. This was obviously just a pretext for expropriating, that is, taking stuff from the capitalists. The absurdity of the penalties is just so obvious that this was clearly just meant to fill the pockets of the Nazi regime. Under fascism, there was no longer an independent judiciary to protect the property of private citizens against the state. So it was very hard to know what to do when you were put upon by the government. You had to just hope that you knew somebody in the regime, or you had a friend in the regime who owed you a favor or something. That was really all you could do. That was the only recourse really that you had. We read in The Vampire Economy, "The decree of February 28, 1933 nullified Article 153 of the Weimar Constitution, which guaranteed private property and restricted interference with private property in accordance with certain legally defined conditions. The conception of property has experienced a fundamental change. The individualistic conception of the state, a result of the liberal, that is classical liberal, of course, spirit, must give way to the concept that communal welfare precedes individual welfare." So that's an official government statement quoted in that book, The Vampire Economy. Then we read by Riemann, the author of The Vampire Economy, "It is conceivable that a businessman might be successful in an appeal to the courts against some regulation of an overzealous Nazi official, provided such regulation were a gratuitous interference with private property and had no bearing on the defense of the Nazi regime. However, court action has been very rare, because most businessmen fear arousing the anger of Nazi officials, who on some later occasion might have opportunity to take revenge. So yeah, sure, go to the courts if you want. But they're going to remember that you did that, and they'll find their way of getting their petty revenge. I think, actually, before I go on to that slide, I want to share with you a passage. Now, you'll see this in the selection, but in case you haven't gotten to it yet, or I think it's useful to hear it a second time, I want to share you a bit, just a small portion of a letter written by a German businessman to an anonymous person, we don't know his name, describing the real situation faced by business people in Germany under the Nazis. He writes, "My dear Mr. So-and-so, I am here in Amsterdam for a couple of days and take this opportunity to write unrestrictedly to various friends abroad. I know you will be interested in hearing what is happening within Germany. As for myself, my knowledge as a technical expert would not have been sufficient to enable me to struggle along during the past 5 years, were it not for the fact that our firm has the backing of a prominent party man, that is, Nazi party man, who comes to our assistance when we need certificates for foreign currency, raw materials, and so on. No firm in our trade can exist without such a collaborator. As it is, we have to spend considerable money for, quote, juridical advice. It is not a question of simple bribery. The process is more complicated. I knew pre-war Russia. In general, bribery under Tsarism was a simple affair. You could figure out how much you had to pay a state official by counting the number of stars on his uniform. The higher the rank, the more stars he wore, and the more you had to pay. It's different in Germany today. Party members who control the distribution of raw materials and similar matters do not offer money to a party leader. You ask him whether he knows a good, quote, lawyer who might be of help in proving to the authorities the urgency of your demand for foreign exchange or raw material. He refers you to a lawyer who gives you the necessary juridical advice for which you pay, and eventually your request is granted. But the fees for this advice are extremely high, much higher than you would have had to pay in direct bribery, or than you would have paid formerly to a first-rate lawyer on a retainer basis. Nevertheless, it is virtually impossible to function at all without maintaining close relations with one of these lawyers. He can tell you whether or not you have a chance to obtain what you are seeking. You come to depend upon him completely. A good, quote, juridical advisor knows exactly how far you can circumvent the law in any given case, or whether or not a recent change in party leadership makes it possible to reinterpret a given decree. I cite one of my own experiences. I needed foreign currency for my current trip to Amsterdam, and duly made a request for what I needed to the Administration for Foreign Currency. In reply, I received the following answer: absolutely impossible. I thereupon went to my advisor and inquired of him how I might prove the special urgency of my business trip. He told me something I had not known before. A new ruling had been issued to the effect that factory leaders in my particular line of business could no longer obtain foreign currency for a business trip abroad. Well, I said, what about a personal trip, in order that I might inspect some new machines for my personal information? This might be possible, he said, but it will cost you 300 marks. I paid the 300 marks and got the foreign currency without further difficulty. And it goes on and on. Like, every aspect of a businessman's life is interfered with in this sort of way. So, for example, as Riemann explains, at least half the time of a German manufacturer is spent on the problem of how to get scarce raw materials, because the German government is committed to rearmament. So it needs all the raw materials. So you better have a darn good reason. And, of course, catering to the consumer, you think that's a good reason? So these raw materials cannot be obtained without a certificate from one of the supervisory boards which distribute the available raw materials. Usually a manufacturer needs dozens of different materials. He cannot work without any one of them. For each one, there is a special supervisory board with a different procedure, with all of which the businessman must be familiar. These supervisory boards estimate how much iron, steel, rubber, and other raw materials are needed by the whole country in order to carry out certain production programs. Now, if a businessman is going to get around these regulations, get around these restrictions, try to avoid interruptions in his production process, he's going to need every bit of ingenuity he's got. Now, for example, it was very hard to get rubber under Nazi Germany. So you can get new tires only if your previous tires are completely worn out. But a lot of people need reserve tires on hand. Well, reserve tires were needed so badly that firms were buying entire vehicles just for the tires. They would take the tires off the vehicle and then just sell the vehicles without the tires for scrap. That's how insane the system became. There's a famous pig-dog price control evasion story. So there'd be price controls all through the economy. You can't sell goods for more than X price. You can't sell a pig for more than X marks. You can't sell a lumber for more than X and so on. Price controls all through the economy. And, of course, people are going to figure out ways around this because all the price controls are irrational. So the story goes, you got a guy who owns a pig, and you have another guy who needs the pig, who wants it for pork. And the guy will come up to the pig owner and say, "How much for that pig?" And the owner will say, "Well, I'm not allowed to sell it to you for more than the official price. But I also have this dog here you might also be interested in. Are you interested in my dog?" And then, so they'll forget the pig. They'll negotiate a very high price for the dog where there's no price control on dogs. And he'll say, "Well, you know what? If you buy the dog, I'll throw in the pig too." And so the guy will buy the dog and the pig. He has no use for this old dog who's loyal to his old master. So he'll immediately let the dog go. The dog goes back to the pig owner. And now the guy has his pig. And they get around the price control on pigs by throwing in a dog that you charge a huge amount of money for, and that allows you to basically pay what should be the going rate for a pig. So it's totally bizarre. And you wind up with cases where the authorities realize that this sort of thing is going on, and they will approach sellers and try to make themselves look like regular buyers, make the seller not realize they're government officials, and try to coax them into violating the price control policy. And then meanwhile, you have the lowering of product quality to cope with price controls. You need to sell your product this price to be profitable. The government will let you sell it for only this price. Something's got to give. So people will just sell lower quality items. And the government rants and raves about this. But what did they expect? One German newspaper wrote, "One necessarily needs a guide to get through the administrative labyrinth that is a very convoluted maze of officialdom. The normal human being needs an assistant who can explain the procedure to him. We are experiencing an era of exuberant growth of new central authorities." So again, the theme of these lessons has been, there is no emphasis here on individual rights. A collective trumps them. In this case, a collective represented by the state. The state's interests trump your interests. We don't care if you need these raw materials. We don't care if you need foreign currency. We don't care what you need. We're going to make your life difficult because our priorities trump your priorities. And we're going to have a secret police going around trying to trick you into violating the price control regulations that permeate the economy. So this is a characteristic feature of fascism. This is obviously not capitalism. This is not even close to capitalism. All kinds of regulations shot through. And again, the so-called public interest, which, let's be honest about what that really means. It means the government interest trumps the private interest. That, more than anything else, is the characteristic feature of fascism. A lot of times people think fascism is characterized by racism, that that's the characteristic feature of fascism. But racism is not necessary to fascism. It may appear in fascism, and obviously in the German case, it's quite prominent. But in the Italian case, we don't see, for example, anti-Semitism in Mussolini's Italy for quite a long time. He was not interested in that until he was an opportunist, and it began to seem like the thing to do. By the time he gets to World War II, and as World War II is going on, and he's currying favor with Hitler. But before that, there was no necessary racial element to fascism. But if there is, well, that's a subset of this more general point that individual rights are not the primary concern of a fascist regime. If you happen to belong to a despised racial group, your individual rights mean nothing to the regime. So what we've been talking about is the exact opposite of the classical liberal or libertarian tradition going back to John Locke and before. Now, next week, we're going to see a regime that, if anything, is even more opposed to the vision of classical liberalism, and that's Marxism, communism. So we'll see you then. Thanks for watching. All right, everybody, it's the moment you've been waiting for. Who is the winner of the sweepstakes we've been talking about and so many of you have entered over the past several weeks, in which Shift Gold is giving away a 1 ounce Canadian gold maple leaf coin? And the answer is Chris Norman, who has not yet been notified, but he will be very shortly. So thanks to everybody for taking part in that. Shift Gold appreciates your interest, and I thought it was very exciting to do this, so I hope you all enjoyed that. Remember, too, my special offer. Now that I'm back home from New York, I can actually start making good on these promises I make to you folks. I can actually come through on some of them. Anyway, I am going to be doing this with my next newsletter coming out in a few days. But remember, I've been offering to all you folks who are thinking of starting up blogs and websites and could use a little bit of a publicity push to get off the ground, that I will give you that publicity push through my social media, newsletter, and so on, as long as you go ahead and get your hosting through one of my affiliate links. And if you have no idea what in the world that is, that's all explained over at tomwoods.com/publicity. That's where you'll also find my new ebook on starting up a blog or website when you don't know anything about programming or design, because that's exactly the situation I've been in over the years. I know nothing about any of that stuff, but I have gotten some pretty nice websites going, and I talked to you about exactly how to do that. And also at tomwoods.com/publicity, you'll see my video showing you how to go in about 5 minutes from having no blog at all to having that blog that you know you've been wanting to start up. So check that out at tomwoods.com/publicity. And remember, too, that in order to get the course that today's episode is drawn from, well, you have several ways of doing it, and they are all linked on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/446. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.